Bluechew.com.
Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. 16 states have legalized marijuana for medical use, and the medical marijuana industry is expected to reach $1.7 billion in sales this year. Last week, Scott's Miracle-Gro in Marysville, Ohio, made national news when the company's CEO, Jim Hagedorn, in an interview with the Wall Street Journal, said he wanted to target the pot market with products aimed at medical marijuana growers. Scott's Miracle-Gro is based in Ohio, like I said, but Ohio is not one of the states where medical marijuana is legal, at least not yet. Coming up, we'll hear from the president of the Michigan Medical Marijuana Growers Association. We'll also talk with a retired Cincinnati police captain representing a growing organization of law enforcement people who support the legalization of marijuana. Right now, Trish Regan. Trish is an investigative journalist and author. She's covered global economic stories for CNBC and NBC News and was the creator and host of CNBC's two most highly rated documentaries, Marijuana Inc. and Marijuana USA. And she is the author of the new book, Joint Ventures, Inside America's Almost Legal Marijuana Industry. Welcome to the show, Tris.
Hi, Ann. Good to be here.
You call the marijuana trade America's Green Rush, like as a play on words to the gold rush. Mm-hmm. You probably weren't surprised by the Wall Street Journal article last week about Scott's Miracle-Gro CEO, Jim Hagedorn, then.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, this has become, more and more popular in the last several years. You're really seeing a movement that's sweeping the country as you have more and more states and Washington, D.C. now allowing some form of medical marijuana, and people are rushing to capitalize on it. I think this is really an example of capitalism at work. People are seizing this opportunity because they see this as an opportunity to make money, and let's face it, there aren't a lot of opportunities when you're in a very down economy. So in places like Colorado, in places like California, where there's a culture, a history there of marijuana use or appreciation, one could say, you now have a situation where in Colorado, in Boulder, there are now more dispensaries, marijuana dispensaries, than there are Starbucks and liquor stores combined, which is a pretty amazing statistic when you think about it. I was certainly floored when I heard it. And you drive down the street, Broadway, for example, in Denver, which has been nicknamed Broadsterdam, and it's, one marijuana dispensary after another. It's really growing at an amazingly fast, you could even say alarming rate, with people now getting medical marijuana cards in Colorado at the rate of 400 new people a day. So that's pretty stunning, and it's also turned into a major revenue source for the state.
What do we know about what the legitimate market is for medical marijuana in the United States?
Well, you cited $1.7 billion. I've actually heard up to $10 billion. It's a very difficult number to decipher because, let's face it, it's all illegal. So there are different ways of looking at the number. One is through what is confiscated by the feds. The other is through what is sold legitimately in dispensaries. And so the numbers are somewhat hazy, but I would certainly estimate that it's at least $1 billion and probably quite north of that. You've also got to consider the profitability here, which is one of the reasons it's worth so much. More than corn, more than grapes, really, one of the most, you could call it, America's biggest cash crop. And part of that is because, the sheer numbers. In California, for example, in Mendocino, where there's a lot of growing activity that's been honed over the years, there's actually more gardening stores in Mendocino County per capita than there are anywhere else in the country. It costs about $400 an ounce to $400 a pound to grow. And that same marijuana can retail on the streets of New York City, and keep in mind it has to cross many, many states to get to New York City, and there's a lot of hazard built in terms of, if you're arrested with that with that product along the way, but it will retail in New York City for roughly $6,000 a pound. Now, there is no other crop in the world that sees that kind of profitability margin. And the reason it has that kind of margin is because, very simply, it's illegal.
So there's a high demand, but the supply is limited because it's illegal.
Yeah. Well, the supply is limited, but it's not entirely that the supply is limited. There are a lot of people out there growing. It's that there's a built-in risk to supplying this, and producers want to be compensated for that risk. And, you know, you could argue they should be, because let's face it, at the end of the day, they're risking going to jail. You know, and that's a risk that they take, and it's a risk that, you know, I've been surprised with so many of the growers and dispensary owners that I've talked with, including, you know, just a lot of sort of regular folks. You know, I spoke with one woman who was running the biggest dispensary in Colorado, and she had two toddlers at home, had never smoked marijuana, had no interest in smoking it. She had an MBA from the university out there, and had worked actually previously for the state running some of their treasury bond portfolios. So she was a pretty, you know, sophisticated finance person and saw this as an opportunity. But I said to her, you know, you got two little kids, a two-year-old and a four-year-old at home. If the feds show up on your doorstep and they haul you off to jail, you know, and she said, yeah, you know, look, it's a risk I'm willing to take. She politically believed in this cause, even though she wasn't a user herself. She felt that people deserved the opportunity to get this for medical purposes. She said one of the hard things, actually, was just knowing that some people, cancer patients especially, were really struggling because it was financially difficult for them to afford this. And one of her points that she cited was if this were legal, you could have insurance, for example, compensating or paying for some of it, which would make it easier on some of these folks. But she said, look, I see this as a business opportunity. I'm an entrepreneur. And I'm running my own business. It is successful. It's a struggle, but you know, this is something that I want to do. So she's, you know, out there essentially risking her family's well-being, you could say, because the feds could show up on her doorstep any day, even though she's abiding by state law.
I want to get to that dichotomy. My guest is Trish Regan. She's a broadcast journalist, and she's author of a new book. It's called Joint Ventures Inside America's Almost Legal Marijuana Industry. If you've seen either of the documentaries that she's produced for CNBC, you've been one of many, many, many millions of people. They're the how many millions watched Marijuana Inc.?
Over 38 million.
Huge in this day and age of cable.
It really is remarkable. I joke that, you know, of course, it is the most highly, both of them were the most highly rated documentaries CNBC has ever done in their history as a network. And then I say, you know, no pun intended. but people, for whatever reason, have been very, very drawn to this subject. I think it's an element of, you know, certainly curiosity, but also, you know, there's an entrepreneurial spirit that I think we all have as Americans. And, you know, there's a movement, as I said, really sweeping the nation where you're seeing more and more states start to legalize this. And people are saying, well, is there an opportunity here for me to cash in on this? Just exactly what is this business? Who are the people that are involved? How are they making money? And these are some of the issues that I really explore in the book, the economics, the business behind all of this.
You know, the whole discussion, you can laugh about it, and we'll probably, you know, there are funny things, and the no puns intended, but it is a serious issue. Interestingly, how you start your book out in your foreword is it's not a new issue to you. You never smoked pot before, but you were exposed to the issue of the marijuana industry early on because your mother was a journalist who covered it.
My mom was a journalist for Boston Globe, and we lived in New Hampshire, and I was about 5 years old, and she was doing an article on the movement at that time to legalize marijuana. This was the early 1980s in New Hampshire. And, you know, what struck me as interesting is you could see the same article being written today because the exact same issue is being debated in New Hampshire. They still haven't gotten to the point where they will legalize it for marijuana use, although I would point out that the House there did actually approve it. The governor struck it down. But, you know, this was back years ago, and I remember this story vividly. It's just one of those things that really sticks out in your mind because I was just 5 years old, and I was told to wait in the living room while my mother, she was a field reporting expedition, basically. She had gone out to interview a woman who was dying of cancer. It was a friend of hers. And I stayed in the living room, and I remember her telling me after I had met this woman once, and she had had the, you know, the turban around her head from all the hair loss and the chemotherapy treatments. My mother was interviewing her for this story because She was struggling basically to secure marijuana. She, this woman needed it for the chemotherapy treatments. At first, she had had her 16-year-old daughter trying to get it, you know, at school, which obviously is just, you know, alarming because you're putting your child in jeopardy like that. And she was worried that, you know, it might be laced with something.
Because back in those days, there was a lot of problems with lacing.
Yeah, so she was having it tested by friends in Cambridge, you know, and then basically found some friends in Cambridge, Mass. That were able to secure some for her that she knew was not contaminated with anything. And her husband had been a member of the military. I mean, they were sort of a very conservative type couple. And, you know, they just thought, this is crazy that the government wants to deny someone the opportunity to have a little less pain when they're going through such a difficult time. And I just remember that story. I remember my mother used to talk about a lot of her stories around the dinner table. It's probably one of the reasons I wound up going into journalism myself. But just it really stuck out at me. And so then here we are this many years later, and you know some of the same issues are being debated, although I would say that the majority of the country, and polls show this, the majority of the country favors marijuana use for medical.
And that's a huge change
from back then,
yeah.
Sure. I mean, you've seen a big shift in the numbers. Part of that is probably due to demographics.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think as the population changes, that you're probably going to see much more acceptance of this, you know, as we move forward.
There are a lot of arguments still out there opposing the legalization of marijuana in general and including medical marijuana. And we're going to get to some of those arguments later in the program. But I wanted to talk to you, Trish, just briefly, you know, in your research, what have you found? What's the state of the art of research into the issue of medical marijuana and whether it actually works, whether those synthetic substitutes are just as good or not? What do we know? Is this just a big ploy, as some people say, to get marijuana legalized in general, or is there a real science behind this?
Well, there is a science behind it, and I've interviewed scientists about this, including a woman at Columbia University who has done a lot of research into this field. And the science has shown that it does help. It most definitely, it's not necessarily a pain reliever. In fact, people that have used it for medical purposes describe it to me as, you know, the pain still is there, but you just don't really care. They sort of said it's a bizarre. It's a bizarre thing in that you don't really, you know, the pain may still exist, you just don't really care. Now, her studies have shown that it most definitely improves appetite. So this is very good for, you know, people who are suffering from debilitating illnesses. As far as the synthetic version of THC, which is the component, the drug, so to speak, in marijuana that really has the hallucinogenic or, you know, pain-relieving effects.
Mm-hmm.
That was approved by the FDA in 1986 for a synthetic version. The problem is that's something that you're taking orally like a pill, and it just doesn't get absorbed into your body quickly enough. You don't feel the effects quickly enough. So, you know, the problem is that there's a big difference, say, between smoking a joint of marijuana and eating it. I mean, that might be kind of the equivalent, or taking this THC. It just doesn't affect you as immediately, so you don't, you're not able to absorb it quite as well. It's not as effective, and this is the reason why people keep going back to, well, you know, this is why the herb itself, the plant itself should be legalized.
My guest is Trish Regan. She's author of a new book. It's called Joint Ventures Inside America's Almost Legal Marijuana Industry. Coming up, we're going to talk with Michael Comorn. He's president of the Michigan Medical Marijuana Association. If you have a question or comment for our guests, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us on allsides@ WOSU.org. And by the way, it's... Michael Comorn, he is president of the Michigan Medical Marijuana Growers Association. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Coming up next hour on All Sides, join 89.7 NPR News host Marilyn Smith for All Sides Weekend Best Food and Restaurants in Central Ohio. Her guests, the Riches Terapak, father and son, WOSU food critics, and Steve Stover, who is the City Scene magazine restaurant critic. That's coming up starting at 11 o'clock.
Support for 89.7 comes from Edible Columbus, a magazine devoted to culinary traditions, seasonal cooking, and the local food movement in our community. More information on the summer edition can be found at ediblecolumbus.com.
Checking the weather forecast for Central Ohio, today mostly sunny with a high about 90 degrees. Tonight, we'll have a slight chance of showers, maybe a thunderstorm late, mostly cloudy otherwise, and a low of 73. Then on Saturday, mostly cloudy. Tomorrow, we'll have a chance of showers and thunderstorms and a high of 86. Cloudy Saturday night with a slight chance of showers and a low of 71. Then on Sunday, partly sunny and a high of 89 degrees. Right now, we have 78 degrees at our studios on the OSU campus.
Welcome back. This is All Sides. We're talking about the economics of marijuana, and still with us, Trish Regan, author of Joint Ventures Inside America's Almost Legal Marijuana Industry. Joining us now is Michael Comorn. He is president of the Michigan Medical Marijuana Association. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, let's be real clear about who you represent. Tell us about your members. There's 22,000 members in your organization, and who are they?
Well, in 2008, Michigan passed the Medical Marijuana Act by referendum, and the people that are members in our group are really anyone can join, but it's primarily patients, people who have been either diagnosed with or have a debilitating condition, as well as caregivers, the people that are designated to cultivate marijuana or medicine for the patients. That's generally who our membership is made up of.
So growers as well?
That's correct. That's why when you say growers, I'm referring to them as caregivers. Those are that's the title given to the people that are assisting the patients grow their marijuana, cannabis, medicine.
Trish and I were talking earlier about that dichotomy between the state laws and the federal laws, that ultimately there's a risk associated with it. How does it work in Michigan? How does the law operate in Michigan, and what sort of threat is there from the federal government, and how do people perceive that in Michigan?
That's a great question. In fact, a state court judge in the last week in Michigan just declared that the Michigan Medical Marijuana Act was unconstitutional because it conflicted with federal law. I disagree with that. That argument has been made in other medical marijuana states. The Michigan Medical Marijuana Act, when it was enacted, in its preamble, states very clearly that states are entitled to regulate issues of medical concern. They've been doing it for a number of years on other medical issues, you know, needle exchange, stem cell research. And it is not something that the federal government can control. The federal government cannot control what the states do. There's an issue of states' rights. If the federal government chooses to arrest and prosecute patients, sick people, and caregivers, they have a right to do that. And they would charge them, indict them, and their case would be in federal court in front of a federal judge. The prosecuting attorney would be the U.S. attorney for that district. It would not take place in state court. When you're in state court and it's a state prosecutor case, it's in front of state judges, state law applies. And the state law of Michigan allows for a affirmative defense, and it allows for protections against arrest and prosecution for any medical marijuana or for any marijuana charge at all.
So do people feel threatened by the law, or is that kind of not that big of an issue in Michigan right now, despite this recent ruling?
Well, the federal issue is a very, very interesting one, because in October of 2009, the Obama policy was very clearly stated that they were not going to use federal resources to prosecute patients, sick people, and the people that are assisting them, caregivers, that are in compliance with state law. Very clearly stated. Subsequent to that, in the last 2-3 months even, when other medical marijuana states, I think there's 4 or 5 of them, were initiating legislation, and it was on their governor's desk to sign and enact into law, with a 180-degree turn, the Obama administration wrote letters to those states saying, if you enact those laws that are going to regulate dispensaries and regulate large-scale commercial grows, we, the federal government, the U.S. attorneys, will indict and charge those state employees. So in the last 2 years, the federal government has completely reversed its position on what it's going to do and how it's going to deal with states who have, you know, chosen to enact medical marijuana laws.
So, Trish Regan, mm-hmm. this is at the whim of whatever the federal government decides to do. The administrations could change ostensibly in a couple of years, and things could change again.
Right. You know, and let's keep in mind that part of this movement that we're seeing right now, when I talk about the fact that in Boulder, Colorado, you have more dispensaries than you do liquor stores and Starbucks combined, part of that came as a result of Eric Holder from the Justice Department coming out with a note saying that the federal government was not actively going to go after medical marijuana producers or users. So all of a sudden, you had this explosion that happened in Colorado and elsewhere all around the country as people basically took that as, okay, well, now we have the ability to just sort of live by our state laws, and we don't have to worry about the federal government intervening. The problem is the federal government, as it now stands, has every right to intervene under the Commerce Clause, and they have done so. I'll give you an example. So there was a gentleman by the name of Chris Barkowitz in his early 30s, was growing in Denver, Colorado. He was growing in his home, and he offered to do a story with the local television station there, the local NBC station, and said, you know, on camera that his grow was worth approximately $400,000. Well, you know, look, I'm a television journalist. We all know the power of the tease, shall we say, in mm-hmm. journalism. And you've seen it, especially during sweet season when ratings is really important for local mm-hmm. television news. So they ran this over and over again with this guy saying, you know, my grow is worth about $400,000. He was also growing in a home in an upscale neighborhood very close to a school. Well, lo and behold, the U.S. Attorney General, in the state of Colorado saw this. And was getting a lot of phone calls on it. And so the next thing you know, he's being arrested at his home the following morning before the story even had a chance to air. Now, he said, well, I don't understand why. I mean, Eric Holder said that, you know, I can grow as long as, you know, my state says it's okay. And the federal government said, yeah, well, we said, no, you can't. And they also pointed out that, you know, he wasn't growing within the sort of legal specifications mm-hmm. of the state. In other words, he was growing close to a school, he was growing more than the recommended amount, et cetera, et cetera. Nonetheless, none of that would even be relevant in court because, as the other guest just pointed out, as Michael said, he'd be going into federal court where they don't even care about state laws. It's just not relevant. And the federal government has made it clear via the Supreme Court in a case called Gonzalez versus Raich that the power of the federal government under the Commerce Clause can be, you know, essentially unlimited for matters of, you know, commerce, and this applies to medical marijuana. You know, there were two women there in California, Angela Raich and Diane Monson, and they sought to use medical marijuana within the bounds of California's law, mm-hmm. Which did allow for the possession and use of medical marijuana. And they, you know, the Supreme Court effectively said, no, you know, you can't do this. One thing I do want to just note was really interesting, that it was actually two very conservative justices that voted for allowing these women to be able to grow because they thought that the Commerce Clause had actually gone too far and that the federal government shouldn't have the power to regulate them at that level, that this was really individual usage. But nonetheless, you know, the way it stands is that that was struck down, and the federal government at the end of the day has the authority and can, in fact, use it and has.
Michael Comorn, in Michigan, are there other risks? Growing the marijuana, it's not something you broadcast, right?
That's correct. I always advise people that they need to live in a culture of security. You know, just to make a comment, when people come in, they're looking for legal advice and counsel on how to go about interacting in the cannabis industry to assist patients, participate, set up a business of some kind. I always say to them, you know, before you start here, go home tonight, and when you wake up in the morning, remember how well you slept, because you're never going to sleep that well again once you get into this business. Because even if you're in compliance with state law, you're always looking over your shoulder if the federal government, for some reason, may decide that they don't like what you're doing, even though you may be in compliance with state law.
Is it kind of a don't ask, don't tell thing? And there's keep it, don't run around bragging like the guy in Colorado. Just do your job, do your business. But there's also other dangers just from people who want to rip you off. Wouldn't there be?
Yes, there is. As far as growing, even in your own house, when people find out about it, you become a target. It represents, you know, a commodity to anyone, and including the criminal element, which may break in and rob you. And it is something that people have to look out for. As far as the don't ask, don't tell situation, I will tell you that I have many, many clients that have come to me who have been arrested, their grow operations torn down, that all took place after they did some kind of news story. So, you know, usually when I see an article in the paper about someone in their grow room with a picture of them and the plants, I know they're going to get charged because that's what they're looking for, the you know, law enforcement agencies. You know, in looking at the dispensaries in other states and even in Michigan, where the federal government has played, you know, come in and arrested and raided places, there's usually something else included. You know, there's usually a very large scale operation. It's associated with some other criminal element. Mm-hmm. I know, for example, looking at the affidavit that was in support of the search warrant for Montana dispensary, like, you know, there was allegations of a lot of cash laying around and growing plants on site, you know, providing cannabis to people that were not medical marijuana patients or didn't have their cards. There was a lot of after sale going on in the parking lots. You know, that kind of behavior, large scale, is going to draw attention on all levels.
I think Michael's making a very interesting point here, and I want to hone in on this a little bit. Michael, you were saying that people who want to grow or are growing are very much at risk in some ways, even in their own homes, that they're just not going to sleep as well at night. And that's because of the violence, that this does contribute to a culture of violence. I mean, anytime something is illegal, nobody has the – if you're the producer, you don't have the ability to govern that or be protected by the normal laws. So, you know, if you're broken into someone who doesn't grow and someone takes something from your home, you call the police and, you know, they investigate it, et cetera. In the case of these marijuana growers, they can't call the police and say, I mean, in many cases, because they're going to risk then maybe drawing attention, it's going to be in the paper,
but
then they have the federal government intervening.
Trish, I get what you're saying, and that's what I want to try to wrap my brain around right now is it's legal. Medical marijuana is legal in Michigan. It's legal in 15 other states as well. If you're growing it legally, if you're following the state laws, why aren't you protected by, in other words, why can't you get the same protections as you do if you're, you know.
Well, it's just harder, right? Because you're running that risk because you call the police and say, hey, you know, I was broken into. And then you, by the way, have to, you know, you'll have to show them all your paperwork. Okay, I was dotting my I's and crossing my T's. Mm-hmm. And it's probably going to wind up in the newspaper. And then you've got the federal government knocking on your door. Mm-hmm. So even though you're playing by state rules, the U.S. attorney's going to see it. And then you're running that risk. So it makes it very hard for people to kind of, you know, work within the system. And that produces a culture of violence because
it's black market.
Acceptable. Right. It's a black market. I mean, one quick point I want to point out is that you now have Mexican drug cartels that are gaining 60% of their revenue from marijuana, because I was telling you earlier, remember, Ann, it is the most profitable drug in the world. So they make more money on marijuana than they do cocaine, on meth, on anything else, and it's the easiest thing for them to do. So the majority of their profits, the majority of their sales and revenue comes from marijuana. So if suddenly it were legal, you'd be taking a big dent out of their business and the violence that goes with it.
Michael?
Yeah, I would add to that. I mean, the United States policy on the war on drugs has been a failure and will continue to be a failure, and it's time to admit that. Michigan is doing an interesting thing, and we're going through the growing pains of this new law. As was being described, there's always this federal threat, always. But we are experiencing something firsthand, which has been shocking to many, many people. And you're talking about people that may not have ever known about, cared about, or even thought to cultivate marijuana, read the law, follow the guidelines, and start cultivating marijuana for a sick person or themselves if they're a patient. What's happening is the implementation and the new way of looking at marijuana in general by law enforcement has not happened. I mean, the community, the medical marijuana community, is moving at light speed, and the law enforcement community is like in Cro-Magnon times. You know, they're still affected by, 70 years of propaganda of how terrible this plant is. You know, much of their resources have been designed to find the marijuana and arrest and prosecute for it. In Michigan, the program that the state is running, the Michigan Medical Marijuana Program that's run by the Michigan Department of Community Health, has taken in $8 million just on application fees alone. They have not spent one penny of it to train law enforcement of what is medical marijuana versus not. And that, and we have a problem going on right now that even though, there's this federal threat, and I know that this has happened in all the other states too. There's always some jurisdictions, some prosecutors that are going to fight it to the death and be on a crusade against medical marijuana. And then there's going to be other communities that are going to embrace it and invite, the medical marijuana community in. But there's a huge dichotomy going on right now in Michigan. In that there's, various attitudes in how the law enforcement from city to city, township to township, is treating it.
As far as the economics go, there's a couple issues I want to bring up before we let Michael go. But before that, Trish, you brought up the Mexican cartel, the Mexican drug lords thing. There's organized crime in the United States. They all profit from the illegal marijuana market. Well, on another note, the laws tend to keep the legal growers, such as they are within the state laws, small. What happens if and when marijuana is legalized or it's the law becomes a national law permitting medical marijuana? Are the big pharmaceutical companies
involved?
The big pharmaceuticals. And mm-hmm. Michael, is there any discussion about that in Michigan about how there's this artificial pressure on keeping the growers small, and then that they see that they have really a limited life in the business if it becomes legal?
Well, one of the arguments going in that direction, which I think the federal government uses also, is that they want to control it, they want to regulate it, and only under those circumstances could they ever see it as being legal. And I understand that for the concerns of getting into the black market. But I could tell you the number of people that have come into my office seeking consultation, seeking some advice and some direction that want to get involved in this industry. Michigan is an extremely depressed economy, and the medical marijuana law provides a lot of opportunity, not just for cultivating, but a number of different aspects of earning money. People that have been out of work, building grow rooms, indoor garden shops have begun, flourishing. Electrical, people to do plumbing in houses, all associated with this industry. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because there's a lot of resistance for this industry to begin to flourish. And there's money there. There's no question about it. It's the number one cash crop in the world. And the discussions oftentimes are just about that. Who's going to control it? Who's going to be making the money? Is it going to legitimately be designed to assist patients and still produce, varieties that are going to, assist the sick people to treat their specific condition? That's oftentimes the concern. The community is adverse to an Ernest and Julio kind of, cannabis, being offered, as opposed to specific strains, specific types that are grown, like a boutique almost,
Yes, Michael, you're so right. I mean, so many people I spoke to in Northern California, for example, Mendocino County, they were angry that there were bigger grow operations coming in. They wanted to keep it very much a mom-and-pop culture. And there's some fear there among growers that the minute you legalize this on a national level, you will have big tobacco companies that know how to, essentially grow this in mass quantities growing it. And they could sell marijuana cigarettes. And by the way, that would depress the price significantly because suddenly you'd be taking out that risk premium that's built into the price that's there right now. And you'd be doing it on a very transparent free economic level that would make this, you know, basically severely reduced in price. And that would put a lot of these small-time growers out of business unless they were able to create such a specialty, such a specific strain, that it essentially was like a very high-priced wine.
Michael Comorn, president of the Michigan Medical Marijuana Association, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. I enjoy it. Have a good day.
Thanks. We're still talking about the economics of marijuana. This is All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Previously on Car Talk.
I think I'm probably going to call him. He'll answer the phone and I'll say,
Jenny, you have a mean streak. You have a mean streak.
You can tell, hey, biology this, pal.
Don't miss the fun this week.
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk comes your way starting at noon tomorrow, each Saturday, on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up at 11 o'clock today, we'll have hour number two of All Sides, All Sides Weekend. Your host, Marilyn Smith. Her guests will be WOSU food critics Rich Terapak Jr. and Sr. and Steve Stover, who is the City Scene magazine restaurant critic. That's coming up at 11 o'clock today on All Sides Weekend.
Support for 89.7 comes from the Columbus Jazz Orchestra, wrapping up Jazzu's sixth season on Friday, August 12th with Elvis, the Beatles, and Beyond, featuring guitarist Dan Fanley of Pink Martini and Jonathan Elliott of the Floorwalkers. Details at jazzartsgroup.org.
In the weather forecast for Central Ohio, the high today should be around 90 degrees under sunny skies. Tonight, a slight chance of showers, maybe a thunderstorm late. Mostly cloudy otherwise, and a low of 73 degrees. Saturday, mostly cloudy. Tomorrow, we'll have a high of 86 and a chance of showers and thunderstorms. Saturday night, mostly cloudy and a slight chance of rain, a low of 71. By Sunday, partly sunny and a high of 89 degrees. Right now, 78 degrees.
Welcome back. We're talking about the economics of marijuana. Still with us, Trish Regan. She's CNBC journalist and author of Joint Ventures Inside America's Almost Legal Marijuana Industry. Joining us now is Howard Rotz. Howard is a retired Cincinnati police captain who served as the commander of the police academy and the SWAT hostage negotiations team. In his previous career, he was a counselor for a methadone clinic and worked in drug prevention. He is a spokesperson for LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, an organization that advocates for complete decriminalization of marijuana. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Thank you.
There are, we tried to get somebody from the government, from the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration to come on the show. It's not necessarily easy to find somebody who will go on the air to counterpoint the points you're going to make. So that'll be my job. But have you always been for the decriminalization of marijuana, or is this a position you came about gradually, or what happened?
You know, I think it came about gradually. I've always believed that the current drug policy has some problems and some changes were needed, particularly moving some resources from law enforcement into prevention and treatment. But when I retired in 2007, I decided to write a book on drug policy. And as I began to research it, it really began to affect me in terms of the violence that's associated with the illegal drug market and the drug cartels. And that's my major interest, is doing something to stop the violence, not only in our cities, but on the border with Mexico and in Afghanistan, where the Taliban uses drug proceeds to kill American service folks.
Folks who oppose what you're saying say that, yeah, that might be true, but the negative effect of allowing marijuana to be legal is overwhelming.
I just have to strongly disagree with that. 40% of Americans have smoked marijuana. We're not starting from zero. If only 2% of people were smoking marijuana, I would say there'd be a change. But one of the reasons you're having trouble with with getting somebody to come on and defend the war on drugs is it's basically indefensible. For 40 years, we've been going down this road. Our use rates are basically unchanged. Addiction rates are unchanged. The only thing we've accomplished is build up the prison industry. And I defy anybody to come on and say with a straight face that the war on drugs has been a success.
Trish Regan, what do we know about the other side of the coin of the economics of marijuana? In other words, how are policies to this point, what they have cost us in terms of criminalization, in terms of adjudication and imprisonment?
Yeah, well, we spend a lot of money, hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars, trying to police this. And you have to ask yourself, is this really the best use of taxpayer dollars? Are we really accomplishing what we want to accomplish? I look to cases like Portugal, and I'd be very interested to hear Howard's impression of Portugal. I spent a lot of time over there. In researching this book, Joint Ventures. And Portugal is the one place in the world where they have decriminalized all drugs, and they've been decriminalized for the last decade. Portugal had such a severe heroin epidemic with about 1% of its population addicted to heroin that 10 years ago it decided it needed to do something completely radical. And its drug czar said, we've got to actually attack the problem as opposed to just spending all of this money trying to police the problem. So what they did was they said, all right, if you're caught with a drug, any drug, there will be no jail time. We'll offer you the opportunity to get treatment. You don't have to take it. It's completely your decision. But we'll offer it that. And what's been amazing is that, all the fears about suddenly Portugal was going to become a drug tourist haven, a drug destination, that you would see a huge spike in usage among the population at large, none of that has happened. In fact, interestingly, in that vulnerable age group, 15 to 18 years old, they've seen a decrease in all drug usage, including marijuana usage. Now, you contrast that, say, with the United States of America, where we have all these prohibitionist policies, and we've actually seen increasing drug usage rates and increasing use among the youth. And so I think Portugal, and I'd be curious to hear Howard's impression of this, but it's a very interesting case study into what might happen if you suddenly said we're going to decriminalize. Let me just also point out that there's still a culture of violence there because they haven't decriminalized the production side, just the usage side. So in other words, some of these drugs that are being produced in Afghanistan, as he mentioned, they're still benefiting the Taliban. And in order to really start to make a dent in all that, you'd have to fully legalize production. But Howard, I don't know if you're that familiar with the Portugal story, but what do you think about decriminalizing on that level?
I'll tell you, I am pretty familiar with what happened there. And I think it's, if we had to choose a place to emulate, I think Portugal would be first on the list. The crucial thing that happened there is in thinking about the illegal market. You've already mentioned that marijuana is 60% of the drug traffickers' revenue. Let's take out their number one product and 60% of their revenue. And who's left but heroin, cocaine, crack, methamphetamine folks who support the illegal market, and they're overwhelmingly addicts. These are our high-volume buyers who are in the market 24/7. What happened in Portugal was those addicts, the number of addicts in treatment increased by 400%. And that's just stealing revenue from the illegal cartels. Every one of those patients represents a huge customer to these illegal markets. We take those people out of the market, and these illegal cartels will wither away and disappear.
Let me also add that
that's what we have to be working on.
They're spending a fraction of what they used to spend policing this. They had overcrowded prisons. Where they had spiking HIV rates from intravenous needle usage, both in prisons and on the streets. They've been able to cut down in terms of their costs of treating HIV people struggling with that disease. They've been able to cut down on costs for their prisons, and they've been able to reallocate some of these funds toward treatment programs, methadone clinics, for example. I spoke with one guy over there who told me, thank goodness for this. You know what? If they had not done this, he would have been dead today. That he still goes in, you know, weekly for methadone treatments. It's, you know, unfortunately for him, an addiction that he has not fully been able to addict. That's heroin. But that if he hadn't, if they hadn't done this policy, he said he would be dead on the street. That he's still alive today for that. So, you know, it's really been what I would call a success story. I would agree with Howard, a success story in Portugal. Whether or not that could be applied in a country as big as the U.S., you know, is an interesting thought, but you know, it's definitely worth looking at because they've done some radical things and had huge success with it.
Howard, our previous guest Michael Colmorn from the Michigan Medical Marijuana Association made the point that although the state is taking in lots of money in fees, millions of dollars in fees from its medical marijuana law, none of it has been invested in educating law enforcement on the issues involved in medical marijuana. Is that true around the country?
I think it probably is. And in terms of investment of this income that's coming in, educate, you know, if we were able to actually utilize this, and I'm not, I don't have strong feelings about medical marijuana one way or the other. My feeling is let's just legalize this stuff, put it in the regulated controlled market, and the day after it's legalized, don't look for Howard Rotz in line to buy any. I don't really care. What my interest is cutting down the violence associated with this.
Let's take
any
a call.
Money that's generated out of the legalization, there ought to be a significant portion of that earmarked for treatment and prevention.
Emmanuel from Westerville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Anna. What I want to comment about is that back in American history, there was a time tobacco and alcohol were not accepted in the society because they think it was bad. Now everybody is drinking that, people are drinking tobacco, and the whole world has not gone down. I don't know why they don't want to change base. Thank you.
We have an email from Bob. Thank you, Emmanuel. We have an email from Bob, too. He says, why distinguish between drugs and alcohol? Alcohol kills. How did alcohol get to be legal while marijuana is illegal? I've never seen fights among people who are high, but many fights among people who are drunk. Trish, how did the culture evolve this way?
Yeah, and I talk about this a lot in the book, sort of the history behind prohibition. Going back to the prohibitionist days, it actually became almost sort of a political movement, and you could point to one man as being responsible for all of this. Basically, he was sort of the czar in charge of making sure that alcohol was illegal. And what he realized, at this time, marijuana was legal. All drugs, by the way, used to be able to actually, Sears Roebuck, in its catalog, had, you know, cocaine tooth drops for children. There was a time when, you know, all of this, you know, you think about Coca-Cola, right? But Coca-Cola actually had cocaine in it when it originated, which is one of the reasons it was sold in pharmacies, for example. I mean, there was a time in history when there was no actual policing of any of this, and so marijuana was sold at that time. Prohibition came about, and basically there was so much violence associated with it. I mean, think about the mob and basically how active the mob was in, you know, shuttling liquor back and forth across states. And they realized that there was no fighting this. Kind of, you know, some ways you could equate it to what's going on right now as, you know, more and more states start to legalize medical marijuana. What the federal government is sort of realizing is that there's just no point fighting this. So when you look back historically, it kind of came down to they wanted this one person who was trying to protect his job wanted to police something. And there was a lot of racism against marijuana because it was seen as something that, you know, a lot of Mexicans and African Americans were using, and they were able to kind of pinpoint this as the drug of choice to police. So when alcohol suddenly became legal, they had something else to actively go after.
Howard, let me ask you, you know, we're talking about there was no percentage in it anymore. They had to legalize alcohol again because it was just wasn't worth it anymore. But, you know, there is something called the U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration, and it's a big, huge agency that does have a percentage in this fight, doesn't it? I mean, there's a whole bureaucracy now created to fight drug use in the United States.
There is, and I think some of the resources, and I know a lot of DEA people, and I like them. I have a lot of admiration for the work that they do. It's extremely dangerous. In Portugal, what happened after the changes that Trish mentioned was that large seizures by the police increased dramatically. I would expect we'd see the same thing here as we move resources from marijuana, possession offenses, and go after the big traffickers, and I think we'd be more effective there.
We have an email from Rebecca on, I'm sorry, it's a note from Rebecca on Facebook. She says, tax, tax, tax. We could pay off our national debt quickly if we had a tax on marijuana, don't you think? That's bandied about a lot, Trish Regan. Is that the case? Does it generate that much money, really? And we only just have about a minute left. I'm sorry, Trish.
Yeah, in the scheme of things, it's not a ton of money, but it's something. And you're also cutting down on the cost that you would be incurring if you were policing it. In California, they estimate they could raise over $1 billion in revenue by taxing it. They've suggested a $1 per joint tax. You'd want to tax it in a way that wouldn't make the price too high because mm-hmm. you would then therefore drive the market back underground. But certainly taxing it would go a long way toward, you know, helping stem some of these budget issues.
Well, Trish Regan, thanks so much for joining us today. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Trish is an investigative journalist and author. She covered, she was creator and host of CNBC's two most highly rated documentaries, Marijuana Inc. and Marijuana USA. And her new book, it's called Joint Ventures Inside America's Almost Legal Marijuana Industry. Also, Howard Rotz, thank you for joining us today.
I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.
Howard is a retired Cincinnati police captain. He's a spokesperson for the law enforcement against prohibition. And thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.